Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 2020-676 and 2020-683. James D. O'Neill and Cleveland Jackson versus the State of Ohio et al. James Derek O'Neill et al. Versus the State of Ohio et al. For the appellant, we have Ms. Shank.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor and your honors. I would like to reserve 8 minutes of my time for rebuttal. May it please the court, Ohio's death penalty is carried out under the methods, processes, and procedures set out in 01-11, a rule that was adopted by the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction without complying with the rulemaking requirements of Ohio Revised Code Section 111.15. Appellants O'Neill and Jackson are both sentenced to death in Ohio and have execution dates. O'Neill on August 16th, 2023, and Jackson is set for June 15th, 2023. Thus, they are soon to be subjected to 01-11's methods, processes, and procedures. Rules subject to 111.15 are invalid if the statutory rulemaking requirements are not followed. And they were not in this case.
Counsel, what's your argument that this is a day-to-day occurrence?
Your Honor, it has not been a day-to-day occurrence so far, but it could be a day-to-day occurrence. It all depends upon the timing and scheduling of execution dates. For example, in Texas, executions are very frequent. Sometimes they'll have two or three in a week. But at this point, it only has the potential.
We're not in Texas. And we've been averaging two or three a year for the last 20 years.
That is true, Your Honor. But even if it's not, and I think you're referencing an internal management rule, even if it's not an internal management rule, it is a rule under the definitions of 111.15. 111.15 says that defines a rule as any standard having a general and uniform operation adopted by an agency under the authority of the laws governing the agency. 01.11 meets that definition. First, it has general and uniform application. It applies to every death sentenced prisoner executed in Ohio. The appellant or appellees admit this, Director Moore testified to it, and there's nothing to contradict that. Second, it was adopted under the authority of the laws governing the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction. Specifically, that's 51-20-01 says on its face that it was adopted pursuant to 51-20-01, and Director Moore testified that it was. In addition, 51-20-01 requires that the department, when it's carrying out duties conferred by law, perform under rules and regulations prescribed by the director. The duty to carry out executions was entrusted to the department under 29.49.22a. Okay. So, yes.
What is the substantive difference between a rule and a regulation?
Well, under the definition, a rule and a regulation are basically are the same thing. The full definition of a rule includes rules, regulations, bylaws, and standards. I'm not sure if is that what you were looking for, Your Honor?
Precisely. Thank you.
Okay.
Counsel, before you go any further, that same section that you just referred to as rule, it does have the last sentence. It says a rule does not include, and it says any order respecting the duties of employees. And the protocol that is in question here, it does govern the duties of employees that are designated with this responsibility, is it not?
Well, certainly there are some aspects of the protocol that address matters that could be considered to be duties of employees.
And what are those?
Well, for example, it sets out the timing of escorting witnesses to the death house. It sets timing requirements for employee training. It sets parameters for who may attend the execution. But so it's a sweeping.
Doesn't even go further though to what happens with the inmate as far as what they eat, you know, and the timing of that, you know, last meal, all that sort of thing leading up to the transport or walk to the death chamber.
It does include all of those things, but what it does that's important here, because the duty entrusted to the department under the law 2949-22 is carrying out the execution. And in this instance, the execution is defined by the statute 2949-22 as an injection applied to the inmate of a drug or combination of drugs that will result in a quick and painless death. And those aspects of the protocol are where we see significant change in the characterization of the duties. For example, no injection is given to the inmate under the current protocol. And as a result of that, without this protocol, the execution process that exists today and that is used on Ohio's executed inmates cannot be found in the language of the rule. So it's possible that it could be severed into some things that fit the kind of duties that do not have to be enacted by rule, but the duties that describe the execution process are entrusted to the department by law, and therefore under 512001 must be enacted by rule.
And I guess it goes without saying that everything that's enacted has to be carried out by staff. It's individual duties here.
Well, yes.
In other words, the rule does not include any order respecting the duties of employees. Seems to me that, you know, revised code 11 or 111.15 is a little contradictory in A1. Everything that has to do with the operation has to be done by through the duties of the employees.
Well, Your Honor, and that is why that I assume the legislature said that duties entrusted to the department must be carried out under rules adopted by the director. Because those duties, carrying out executions, there could hardly be anything that is more substantial in terms of the impact on a human being than having an execution carried out. It makes sense that a department that incarcerates and punishes is a department that the legislature said in 512001 must enact rules to carry out duties entrusted to it by law. And there is no dispute as far that it was entrusted by law. It's on the face of the protocol, and it is the director's testimony. So
from just a policy standpoint, you're looking for this to be codified into the Ohio Administrative Code for transparency, correct?
I apologize, Your Honor. I could not hear your question.
Okay, so for the sake of, I don't think I'm muted, no. For the sake of just the motivation to pursue this action, it's because of transparency, correct?
Transparency is an important part of it. In fact, I think that transparency is a significant issue. During his deposition, Director Moore testified that the difference between a policy is that and a rule is that a policy can be promulgated under the authority of the director as ultimately through 512001, and an administrative rule has a set of requirements that ultimately ends up in front of a legislative committee with a public hearing That is the difference. So a significant aspect of the difference recognized by the ODRC when they failed to comply was that they didn't have to go to a legislative committee and they didn't have to go to a public hearing.
But let's presume that the director of the ODRC and the employees who carry out this very grave task are giving it their all, and they're trying to do everything right, and they're trying to do this in a way that is quick and painless. I think that the rule does not include orders respecting the duties of employees. Things can happen as they have in the past, and things can change. Perhaps a drug provider won't give the department that drug anymore, or perhaps they find that if we just did this a little bit differently this way in our established protocol, it would actually make things more humane for the prisoner. And so should the department have to be bound by the onerous process of rulemaking, which requires days and weeks and months and public hearings, and frankly, a lot of opinions from JCAR, when oftentimes with them being right there working with the prisoners, they may need the ability to pivot quickly to do it in a caring way?
Well, first, Your Honor, there really is no execution that the specific date that it's set for, at least as far as I am aware, is critically needed to be done on that particular day. Our system is designed to allow opportunities for more time with issues with court processes, with issues with power outages. There's nothing that says it has to happen that day. If something comes up and there is a need to make a change, no one is harmed by taking the time that justice requires to make the change in conformity with the law. And the law is 111.15 and carrying out the rulemaking authority there. Plus, remember, 512001 places a special and specific duty on ODRC to carry out the duties imposed by law on that department by rule. So letting it slide, saying it needs a quick action, saying that we don't need to comply with those laws does not actually benefit anyone.
Well, I'm only thinking about instances in the past. I'm looking back in 2009 when the prisoner is on the table and things aren't working right, and they tried for a long period of time, and I think it's kind of immeasurable what that does to the prisoner, what that does to the prisoner's family, and more so even to the victim's family. I guess I'm just having a hard time. I wanted you to talk about some of these because all these other things are technical and we can look at all these issues, but I really wanted to see what the motivation was here to pursue this as we look at the technical arguments.
Well, I think one of the primary motivations here is, and this is a declaratory judgment action, we're just finding out what the actual parameters of the law are. Is critically important. I mean, knowing on the day that a person is facing execution that the law has been complied with and that what they're facing has been reviewed and tested and understood by the legislature, public comment, and upheld by a court simply is important. To go to an execution date as a prisoner and feel that the process that's being used to carry out your death is not the process that the Ohio General Assembly said was supposed to be used, makes that something other than a legitimate punishment. Understanding and clarity about the source of the law and the application of the law is critically important. So that alone is a very important aspect of this litigation. And finding that out, knowing that answer, will be redress for both O'Neill and Jackson.
Counsel, the protocol for executions in Ohio has been stayed by the federal courts at times, correct?
At times.
And now, unless my understanding is not up to date, the federal court has signed off, so to speak, on the current protocol. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, it's still under litigation. There have been some executions that have been allowed to proceed under this protocol, but the questions about the protocol continue, the litigation continues. So I cannot say that there's a final order out of the court on the legitimacy of the protocol.
Okay, but the last, what we understand last from the federal court is they allow this protocol to be utilized to execute prisoners.
That's true. But okay. I will point out, Your Honor.
Wait a minute. Let me ask the question. So how does that interact with, I guess, your position that somehow the protocol is illegitimate?
Well, the federal court litigation focuses on the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution. There, the standard is whether or not it's cruel and unusual punishment. Ohio's General Assembly has said that the executions that will be used by this state must be quick and painless. So all of the assessments that have been done in the federal context, actually, I believe the Sixth Circuit has admitted that the process that we use has some aspects to it that are painful. So whatever the federal court has done, it's under federal law. It does not address the Ohio statute. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But it's impossible to have an execution that doesn't have some sort of pain associated with it.
I respectfully believe that that's not true, Your Honor. I know that there are certain gases that people can inhale. I think it's something like nitrous oxide. There are many other options out there that can result in an actual painless death. I mean, the reason that I mention that is because there are OSHA rules about those who work around it. Your body thinks it's oxygen, and so you don't know anything's wrong until you are passed out. So it's not true that there is not a way to execute someone painlessly. So Ohio's standard can be met. So I'm going to go on to the Court of Appeals ruling. We've already talked a little bit about the order. And what I wanted to say to you was that the first and most significant reason that we should recognize that it's an order is the fact that Director Moore, the one who adopted it, testified extensively in depositions about it. And it was always either a protocol, a policy, or on a few occasions, he even called it a rule. He is the director who would have been issuing it as an order, were it in order, and he never said it was an order. I think the fact that it's self-executing is apparent. The law in Ohio is firm. Probasco v. Rain and State v. Toney say that once a statute's enacted, that's the law. The final thing I wanted to mention briefly, I think I'm running it up against my time. I can't, oh, there we go.
Counsel, you're over your time. So we will move on now to Mr. Hendershot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. Jackson and O'Neill face both a threshold problem and a merits problem. But I want to start off with the Chief Justice's question about the definition that includes both general and uniform, but also carves out orders to employees and how do those fit together. And what I would direct you to is the language effective in subparagraph B1 of the statute. We think that word effective, a rule is effective if it follows the process, it's not effective if it doesn't. What that points out, and I think this is well illustrated by the cases that I'll mention in a moment, is that a rule is something as the force of law and is necessary to authorize the executive action, whatever it is, across all the contexts. Remember, this statute doesn't just apply to the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, but to all the executive actors of the state. So that word effective, and let's move on to the cases and see how that distinguishes this court's and other courts' cases. So you have cases like Adams and Saunders saying things that are not rules. Why is that? because those things do not need to have the force of law to authorize executive action. But contrast that.
Are you saying that if a statute requires that rules be promulgated, that until the agency promulgates those rules, they cannot take any action under that statute?
Well, I'm saying, yes, when rulemaking is required for certain kinds of action, I think this explains the internal management rule piece of this and all the parts of 111.15. Now, we think that many executive actions can take place without rulemaking, and that, we think, is the key problem with Jackson and O'Neill's theory, is that they look primarily at the general and uniform language and not the carve-out for orders to employees. And I think it also clashes with the cases that recognize Adams and Saunders. I'll keep coming back to those as two of this court's cases that draw the line between mere implementation and interpretation and establishing a policy. And so that line, we think, is something that Jackson and O'Neill's theory butts up against. And it also, I think, connects with the question, Justice Brunner, that you asked about flexibility. So certainly, if we just use the general and uniform test that Jackson and O'Neill are proposing, it eliminates flexibility, not just for the guidelines we're talking about here, but across all executive agencies. And that flexibility, as I think your discussion with Ms. Shank pointed up, if you have something sitting before JCAR, you lose the flexibility to adjust things. And that's exactly what if you look at the statute that authorizes these sentences, by not specifically pointing to either rulemaking statute and by leaving that flexibility, that's what the General Assembly was intending here, was to leave these sort of checklists and guidelines to employees. I mean, the protocol describes itself as a guideline. It talks about approximate timelines. It leaves discretion to the director to adjust things. And if you look at former Director Moore's testimony, here's just one example. He said, this is a page 65 of his deposition, that many times they did adjust things like visitation schedules and so forth, so that an inmate that requested more visitation time, they varied from the policy, not in a way they had to go and let that rule sit before JCAR for months, but instead within the 30-day window or the 7-day window or even the day of window of carrying out the sentence. Now, let me back up for a moment and mention the threshold issue, because I think it's one of two independent reasons to affirm what the 10th District did here. And that's a question about redressability. We think that Jackson and O'Neill lack standing because they lack redressability. Redressability requires that an order of the court would change something on the ground. It would redress the injury. And here, and I would point this court to its 2018 decision in the Food and Water Watch litigation, where it said in paragraph 23, the possibility that rulemaking would change something on the ground is not enough to establish redressability. You need a certainty that rulemaking would change things on the ground. And here, nothing about this protocol being either unwritten, written informally, or being a formal rule changes the power of the department, indeed the duty of the department, to carry out this very grave task. And we think if you ask
who else would have standing then than the person being executed?
Well, sometimes there just isn't standing, Your Honor. And right. Standing is not something that exists in every case to litigate every disagreement you may have with the way that the government is operated.
I agree with you on that. But is there anybody else that would have standing?
Probably not, since these are orders to employees. I mean, I suppose maybe it's conceivable, and here I'm not just thinking about this protocol, but these internal things that really are internal management rules, maybe if they direct certain employee action, possibly they would have standing. But at the very least, have redressability, the rulemaking has to change the outcome. So that comes straight from the Food and Water Watch. So there could well be things that are, well, we'll just take some examples from the case law. So in the B&T Express case from the 10th District or the Ohio Nursing Board case from this court, in both cases, this court said, the particular action, the fine against the motor carrier in Express and the nursing license in the Ohio Nursing Board decision, this court said those needed to be rules. There was standing because that would have changed the possibility of fining the motor carrier or the scope of the LPN license in the Ohio Nursing Board case. So that both shows how you would have standing. And we think also connects with our theory, again, keying in on the word effective, that shows to be a rule, it must be something that is required, has the force of law, and is required to authorize executive action. that explains cases, again, like Adams and Saunders, those do not need to be in place to authorize the executive action going on there. One practical point, Your Honor, beyond the flexibility issues that I mentioned before and why even those subject to this protocol, we think, would want the flexibility that former Director Moore testified to, and the kind of flexibility, I don't think this incident was in the record, but there have sometimes been adjustments to the procedure to accommodate medical issues that arise for the inmate. But another practical point is revised code 121.95F. It's a relatively new statute, but it requires that when new regulations are put in place, that two existing regulations are taken off the table. Well, if Jackson and O'Neill are right, that everything that is general and uniform must be something that is put in a rule, immediately that will take other rules off the table. And then someone will point to those and say, well, those were rules. Those needed to be rules. You have this sort of snake eating its tail problem if the very broad definition that Jackson O'Neill proposed goes into effect. So that just shows that looking at the revised code as a whole shows the problem with Jackson and O'Neill's theory.
Counsel, that section that you just referred to, where if you impose a rule, you've got to eliminate a rule. Am I understanding that?
Yes, that's the way I reread the statute, Your Honor, that it's a two-for-one reduction.
All right. Does that indicate that the establishment of rules is disfavored by the legislature?
Well, it's suggesting that maybe agencies should take a look and only put things in rules when it is necessary. It certainly is suggesting that at times to not over-designate things rules. I think that's at least one lesson. I don't want to try to get into the mind of everyone that voted on that, but I think the text of it certainly suggests agencies should take a close look, and fitting that together with the statutes that do require rulemaking, it just shows that it's not as all-encompassing as Jackson and O'Neill's theory would inevitably lead to. So we think it not only clashes with the carve-out for orders to employees. When you read through this protocol, it's plainly a checklist, a series of orders about what to do approximately, it uses the word approximately many times, what to do when. And we think Jackson O'Neill's theory also clashes with the cases. It can't draw the dividing line that this court has already drawn between, use the words in Saunders and the Ohio Nursing Board decision, drawing the line between implementation and establishing a new policy. Nothing about this protocol establishes something in the way that the scope of the nursing license was established, in the way that the fines against the motor carrier were established in the Nursing Board and the B&T Express cases, respectively.
Mr. Hendershot, when you're saying you have to, if you impose a rule, you have to eliminate a rule, you're talking about amendments. You're not talking about new rules, correct?
Your Honor, I think that statute applies to new rules. I mean, many of them may fall in B amendments. But I guess it depends on how you interpret that statute. But even if you put that aside, I think the language, just cabining ourselves to 111.15 and taking account of the language saying that orders to employees are exempted, and then using that to draw the line this court has drawn between implementing and establishing, that we think plainly shows that this policy, this protocol, falls on the orders to employee side. And that leaves the kind of flexibility that simply makes sense in this context, where those doing their best to carry out the gravest thing that our government does have the flexibility to do so. And one other thing related to flexibility is transparency. It's true that in some cases, making something a rule increases transparency, but this protocol has been transparent for decades, frankly. It's been on the internet. You can find it from anywhere in the world. There's nothing being hidden here, in contrast to some other states that certainly don't publish everything about the details. And if you read through the protocol here, I mean, everything is laid out in some significant detail.
Counsel, if a rule was established, I mean, if we said you have to have a rule, and then presumably the contents of this procedure as is in place now would just be transformed into a rule. Is that fair to say?
I guess that's what I take Jackson O'Neill's request to be, is that something exactly like what the protocol looks like goes through the formal process and then becomes.
All right. In the formal process of establishing a rule, is there debate and discretion by the authority approving the rule
Well, I think, I mean, certainly as Director Moore testified, there was a lot of debate and discussion to establish this protocol. What would happen?
Well, I understand that. I understand that. That's a different arena. When you establish, a rule is submitted, what is the oversight and who gives it the stamp of approval?
Yeah, that depends on whether it's an internal management rule or not under this particular statute. So dividing off the 119 rules, which are even more formalized with public comment, here, if it's an internal management rule, it simply has to be filed. If it's the everything else category, it's something that it goes before JCAR for their comment. And my understanding and practice is that almost never results in, it's up to JCAR, as I understand it, to have any kind of hearing, and almost never happens. There is a lot of rulemaking, although maybe there'll be less with this new statute. But it is the vast majority of the debate about this, as former Director Moore mentioned, was on the inside DRC and talking to all the stakeholders that are involved in it in that instance.
So the debate over whether or not the death penalty, we should have the death penalty, or the death penalty is constitutional or whatever, that takes place and will continue to take place in the courts.
And of this, course.
This is what seems to me as a request for an administrative action.
Yes, John, although we recognize it deals with a very grave subject, the actual particulars that are in the protocol have been the subject of ongoing and continuous federal court litigation as long as I've been with the office, and I think it predates me by quite some time as well. So those have been tested repeatedly before the Federal District Court in the Sixth Circuit, including the Sixth Circuit en banc a couple of years ago. Your Honors, at bottom, we think there are two independent issues here, a standing issue, and I'll direct you to paragraph 23 of Food and Water Watch on that, and a merits issue, especially looking at the word effective, and a theory that we have offered you think draws the line that this court's cases do, whereas Jackson and O'Neill's theory would really encompass almost everything out there because they focus on the general and uniform language. For either of those reasons or those that we've offered you in our briefing, we ask you affirm the judgment of the 10th District. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Shank, you've used all your time. You may take a minute. You have to unmute yourself.
Your Honor, I think that the question of agencies enacting rules that are not required, which is what was raised by Mr. Hendershot, is not at issue. This is a case where an agency required by law to enact a rule did not do it. Remember that 512001 is the specific statute requiring ODRC to enact rules when a duty is entrusted to it by law. The parade of horribles isn't going to happen. Many duties of employees can be put into rules, but they're not ones that are entrusted to the agency by law. Agencies have been complying with 111.15 for decades without problem. There's no reason why ODRC can't do it here.
Counsel, what's your response to your colleague's argument on standing?
Well, Your Honor, the fact that the statute says that you can seek a declaratory judgment and it can't be objected to because you're seeking a declaration of law, it answers the question by itself. But in terms of there's a controversy and it's real. And O'Neill and Jackson can't wait until they try the protocol out on them to see whether or not it's okay, because they won't be alive to challenge it. And finally, the fact that they're standing, there actually is redress in getting that declaration of law. And I think the General Assembly recognized that when it adopted the Declaratory Judgment Act. So with regard to this case, it's a rule. 01.11 is a rule. It doesn't assign existing duties. It defines first what those duties are, because they said they found 2949.22 vague and in need of interpretation. They could not apply that statute without a rule because they didn't know what it meant until they put their own interpretation to it. So it's a rule because it is a defining statutes, the meaning of statutes. It's enacted under the law, giving that job of carrying out executions to the ODRC, and it clearly has uniform and general application. This court has said strict compliance with the protocol is required in State versus Broome. If strict compliance is required, and remember, we're talking about what was entrusted under 294922, all those other things that are they're talking about, giving a pillow, escorts, the many things that Mr. Hendershot listed are not part of 294922. What has to be enacted by rule is how the actual execution by injection applied to the inmate of a drug or combination of drugs that will result in a quick and painless death is carried out. That's the core. That's where the rule has to be. The fact is that the protocol includes in it some, under Roman numeral 5, I believe it is, some requirements that are not variable. There's no question that portions of this protocol are in fact uniform and applied generally because they can't be varied. So every inmate that's subjected to it is going to be subjected at the bare minimum to those unvariable components of the rule. So we
thank
don't.
You. Thank you, counsel.
Thank we'll you, Your Honors.
We will take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Thank you.
Thank you.